that they got planned. There's three that they plan on doing, but two that plan on going off in 2017. So, with that and the EVA going on, there's so much, Dick, I don't know where to stop, so I'm going to just stop. Back to you. Big EVA again this week to redo the cooling system on the International Space Station. I have plenty of details on that. It's a whole ammonia system, being a steam fitter myself. I'm naturally fascinated with that topic. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N Space Report 174.
When it comes to the description of that EVA, I think you're going to be telling us that there was some additional ammonia leak that wasn't quite solved completely during the last EVA. But let me backtrack, Paul. 90% of the fuel of the hydrogen and oxygen on a second day scrub of the space shuttle, for instance, was recovered. And the way the main rocket engine works, the liquid-fueled rocket engine, you've got turbo pumps that are pumping the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen at rather high pressure into both the lines that go around the nozzle to cool it so it doesn't melt down, and eventually into the actual combustion chamber. I am guessing that at the instant of combustion, the liquid oxygen has been converted to gaseous form, the liquid hydrogen has been converted to gaseous form in the combustion chamber. I'm guessing that you're burning gaseous hydrogen and gaseous oxygen. That if you just simply put the liquids together, I think you wouldn't get the desirable reaction. So I am guessing that the turbo pumps, when the rocket engine is under full blast power, the turbo pumps are producing just the right pressure of the liquid going through those veins of the nozzle, and the veins of the nozzle are picking up the heat of the combustion. Therefore, that's where the liquid is converted to the gaseous form. And so when it's running, that looks great. But the startup procedure, when the engine is not yet hot, I guess what's really going on is the liquid hydrogen. Let me drop. The liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen hitting the nozzle that is so-called cold, which really means room temperature. And because the liquid hydrogen is sitting at some ridiculously cold temperature, like I'm guessing 50 degrees Kelvin, you know, minus 220 degrees centigrade, I'm guessing when it hits the room temperature nozzle, from its point of view, that's hot and it gets converted to the gaseous form. So I guess the startup is not quite as spooky as I was first thinking. Have I got any of that approximately right, the way that rocket engine really works up, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, that's right, but that first split second is some other kind of fuel. It's called TEO. I'll have to look it up. TEO, and then there's three other letters that they use. TEO, and then another T. I forget the... And it's big long name of the type of fuel, and that has something to do with the startup procedure. That's some kind of a hypergolic reaction, almost like an ignition type of system that the space shuttles were using. But yeah, they all have their own way of doing it. You know, the most common fuels for a lot of the rockets are RP-1, rocket propellant, one they call it. It's really kerosene, so they're going to have a different ignition system than the space shuttle or the Delta IV rocket. Delta IV is similar to the space shuttle. Space shuttle has the RS-25 engines, which are hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and the Delta IV has RS-68, similar type of system that the shuttle has. Most of the other rockets all have regular rocket propellant fuel, so different ignition systems on both. And of course, when you get to space, it's all different too. Once I go to the moon, they're not using those necessarily you know, fuel, a lot of different fuels that have been used over the years, Dick. But the shuttle had some other kind of ignition fuel to start with, I think. I don't remember.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Which are abbreviations for this long, long type of fuel that they use. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of the SR-71 Blackbird aircraft, which used a very special fuel, JP-7, I think it was called, it was a petroleum-like fuel, kerosene-like fuel, which had an extremely high flash point. You could take a cup of that fuel from the SR-71 and put a lighted match into it, and it'll simply put out the match. In order to ignite that engine, they would spin up the engine by way of a almost 1,000 horsepower external engine would be pouring electrical power into that turbine to spin it up. And then in order to make sure that the fuel would ignite, they would squirt TEB, tetraethyl borane. It sounds like a Thomas Echo Bravo, if you know what I mean. Tetraethyl borane was a chemical that explodes on contact with air. As soon as air hits it, it explodes. So they would squirt that into the engine to make sure that it would ignite. I wonder if it's something similar to TEB being used on making sure you got ignition in the space shuttle liquid engine. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's that type of thing. And that might be the other three letters that I'm looking for. It's a combination of the two. But I'll have to check. But yeah, you're right. That's the way that they do it. And the X-15, yeah, some form of alcohol, too, was involved with that, wasn't it, one time, Dick? I don't remember. But on the X-15, but on the Blackbird, it might have been the other fuel that you just mentioned. But I think the X-15 was alcohol-based. They've used many different types of fuels. And in the future, you're going to see Blue Origin. They have their rocket, the BE-4 that's coming out. It's being developed. It's already fired, I don't know, thousands of times in a test facility. Blue Origin has the BE-4, and that's going to be liquid natural gas, LNG, liquid natural gas. You can imagine flying with that. What's involved? You've got SpaceX coming back in December, and they run RP-1 kerosene, and now they're going to—it's going to be an enhanced system. Let me drop it. They're going to pretty much cryogenically cool the kerosene, and the idea is to lower its density. They're calling it densification. So they're going to try to lower the density of the kerosene instead of just like room temperature. They're going to like really chill it down. And by doing it, you can actually compress is a word, wrong word, really lower its, or actually raise its density. So essentially you're putting a lot more fuel onto the same rocket. Combining that with a new enhanced Merlin 1D rocket for bigger output, for more thrust, and also having a stretch, they're going to have a longer second stage tank with this new rocket that's going to be going up for return to flight for SpaceX. It's got to be 30% more load that they can get up to either low Earth orbit or geosynchronous. And in this case, it's going to be around a 400-mile high orbit for the satellites that they're going to be launching in December. So a lot of different fuels for different rockets. Back to you, Dick.
Dick, I believe the Blackbird was JP-9, no longer available.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise. surprised me that I got the JP number wrong, but I know that it was a very high temperature ignition fuel, very low volatility fuel, for a whole bunch of reasons. First of all, it was a wet wing. In other words, there was no fuel tank. The skin of the wing was the outer surface of the fuel tank, held together with the rubber seals on the individual skin panels. And until the airplane got up to full temperature and the skin panels expanded, it would do a lot of leaking. And if that was leaking a gasoline-like fuel, oh boy, would you have a fire hazard. Because this JP-9, I guess you said, was such a non-flammable petroleum-based fuel, a very special kind of kerosene. The fact that it leaked out is not a danger because the stuff can't burn until it goes into a very special engine and gets a blast of this tetraethyl boron, TEB, to ignite it. The TEB creates a flash of some, you know, ridiculous number of degrees Fahrenheit in order to ignite the fuel to start the engine. And the Blackbird SR-71 would carry enough of the TEB for something like a total of 6 restarts, I believe. And because your mission consists of some number of refuelings, and there's always the possibility of getting a flame out, you got to be able to restart that engine. In fact, they do a restart procedure if an engine stops giving thrust. They kill both engines and restart both of them in order to get everything flying back even. If you're getting thrust out of the engine on one side and not the other side, the airplane starts flying sideways so fast that within a fraction of a second, the pilot's head literally smacks against the side of the cockpit and can give him a concussion. It happens so rapidly when you fly.
Repeater, timeout.
It happens that rapidly when you're flying at Mach 3.2. Within a fraction of a second, you're starting to fly sideways. In fact, during some of the early flights, they literally had a breakup of the airframe because of the engine thrust on one side not equaling the thrust on the other side. Very exotic airplane. And so, in fact, the space shuttle also is a very exotic airplane. Total of, I think it's 6.5 million pounds of total thrust when that thing takes off. Something like 2.5 million pounds is the solid rocket boosters, and the rest of it is the liquid-fueled engines. And so, zillions of gallons per second are pouring through that engine. Do you remember how fast the engine? I think you told us it's something like a 9-inch diameter piece of tubing is pouring the fuel into that engine. WS2N, K2RAW, the TechNet.
Oh, in the space shuttle, yeah. Well, it's a 5.5 million pound thrust. You got most of your thrust from your two solid booster rockets. Quite a setup. It was all being supported by 8 bolts. Each bolt, talking about the size, each bolt was like, it was four bolts for each solid booster rocket holding it to the pad. And the diameter of each one was like 5 inches. So 5-inch bolt, there's four of them on one side, four on the other. And that whole setup was attached to the external tank, and then the shuttle itself was attached to the external tank. So the whole stack was being held up by bolts, explosive bolts. You know, they would actually explode and blow the nuts off, and that's how you free the whole shuttle for takeoff. But the diameter of the you had piping system going from the external tank to the space shuttle. The diameter of the oxygen and hydrogen piping going to the space shuttle was 17 inches in diameter. And they had big doors and everything, and they would close after separation, and the doors would close, and they had tiles on the bottom of the doors to protect the shuttle. So it all had to work, you know. The set tank separation that would have to separate these 17-inch pipes, and after it was separated, these panels would close, and on top of the panels where were attached these tiles. It all had
Timeout. Cancel.
17-inch diameter fuel tubing. Wow. When that external tank disconnects from the space shuttle, and that 17-inch diameter piece of tubing is going to disconnect, what in the world does that connector look like, Paul? Is there a male and female connector? And is that held together with an explosive bolt, and that has to come apart? How in the world do you disconnect a 17-inch diameter piece of tubing and seal it off and then close the door in that area? Boy, that must be a fancy mechanism. Over to you, Paul. K2LAW.
I've looked into it very closely, and I can't get enough detail. It's very frustrating. But, I mean, I've gotten to the point where I know the diameter, and I've seen the separation of it many times. But you just, you know, it's not a close enough look. I wish I could see an exploded view of how they do it, so I can't answer the question on how they do the exact separation. You know, they have to close off the tank 100%, you know, the external tank. When it separates, you can't have more, you know, excess of, you know, fuel flying out. I think you really need some kind of instant valve closing on both sides, on the shuttle side and on the tank side. But I don't know. You watch the close-up films of the later, last 20 shuttles when they had close-up views, and you could see the doors closing on, you see these doors closing right after the separation on the orbiter. It's amazing. Thank you, Dick.
Meteorio with a question on the subject. Yeah, I've got a question also. But go ahead, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Paul, WS2N, W2RYY. I'm sure you've watched the DVD video I gave you a couple months ago. And it's just like all the other launches. One thing I've noticed, and I've got a question reference that. You mentioned at the bottom of these rockets, just before the launch, like sparklers seem to go off or something. They set something off. I've noticed that sparklers come out horizontally right below all three of the nozzles. And like a second or so later, boom, the thing ignites. Are those for ignition purposes, or are those for some other purpose besides trying to ignite the gaseous fuel coming out? Back to you.
Yeah, that was a very good video that you sent me. Very good, very descriptive from the beginning to the end. Very well done. They call them sparklers. You know, they have these right before the ignition. You see them going off. These little sparklers all over the very bottom of the engine. That's what I was trying to mention before. And you know, as they get down to zero, you know, the first bit of hydrogen that's pouring out of the exhaust of the shell has not ignited yet. You know, these other chemicals have to ignite, and then the next thing you know, the fuel is now lit. But that in the beginning is a lot of excess hydrogen that is not burnt off, and they don't want that, you know, coming out of the bottom of the shuttle and rising up to the, you know, next to the shuttle and creating a possible hydrogen explosion on the sides of the shuttle. So they have these sparklers coming off. So that first bit of, we say a little bit of hydrogen, there's a lot of excess hydrogen that is not ignited yet, and that's what those, they call them sparklers, are doing. So you see, you know, all flashing right before the ignition, and yeah, you're right, that's the same time that it comes on, and that's what it's for. Back to you.
I've also noticed something else, and if you got a very good eye, you look very quick, very carefully at the whole thing, the launch sequence, the split second after the nozzles are all three of them lit, and you can see the flame come out, first of all it's orange, then it turns into something almost completely clear, like a clear type of flame, like it looks so pure. But if you notice that nozzles will exactly align where they got to be, and then boom, they let the solid rockets go, and then off she goes. I've often wondered, why is that? Why don't they have their pre-position exactly as it's supposed to be, instead of moving them after the nozzles are actually lit, and that's what half second or so before it's let go off the pad. Back to you.
I know the gimbling of it, of those nozzles occur right before launch, and they want to make sure that's working. If that doesn't move, what's going to happen is they have to be angled a little bit right in the beginning. The idea is to clear the tower, get away from the tower. They don't want to drift into the tower. And for any reason, that gimbling does not take effect right at that last split second. The computers will shut it down. And they've had that before, where they'll shut the shuttle down. And, three engines will come on, and, they'll ignite, and then, the computer will shut it down. It's before the solids lit. The three engines light up first, and then the solids go. If the solids go, that's it. There's no way to shut the solids off, so, you're gone. You have to leave the launch pad. But right before the solids go, you do have time, and it's happened where you have the rockets fire, and then they'll shut the computer, will shut it down. And then there's other things going on. You see the water being forced in from all the different directions. And you'll see that on other manned and unmanned launches, too. Falcon 9 has it, there's quite a few things going on right in the beginning of flight. They always show a close-up of that. Well, it's all being fed back to flight control. They're all monitoring everything that's going on there. Not just the pictures, of course, but the telemetry. How many gallons a minute all the water is pouring out. The water, and the water is used for sound. It's not really for fire. The reason you get all that water is to stop vibration. They didn't have that water for the first flight in Columbia in 1981. And right after that, they put that in as a sound vibration eliminator. I don't know. We'll turn it back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
Yeah, I think the sequence of lighting is you start, turn on the sparklers, which I'm guessing might be little strips of magnesium that are being ignited and being thrown out by some kind of a grinding wheel-like thing, is my guess. And the each one of those little strips of magnesium burns for a certain length of time, and we call that the sparklers. That's a guess. I don't know what they really are. But you light up the three liquid engines. They're producing their thrust because they are higher than the center of gravity of the craft. The thrust of the liquid engines causes the whole shuttle to deflect so that the top of the shuttle goes closer to launch umbilical tower, and it's a sort of a spring action. The nose of the shuttle goes closer to the launch tower, then it swings back. It's on the back swing that at the right time they ignite the solid rocket boosters, and off you go. So in that first couple of seconds of swing, they're measuring the fact that the three liquid engines are giving you full thrust. The swing has occurred just right. And the deflection of the engines that Joe was talking about, I am guessing it's possible that some of that deflection is the thrust of the engine creating a little bit of deflection of the mounting structure of the engines, very similar to the mounting structure that's holding the whole space shuttle down to the pad. It's got some springiness to it. It's, a couple hundred feet high, the total vehicle. Let me drop it. And so it deflects, it looks to me like it deflects a healthy 5 degrees toward the tower and then springs back. And it's on the backswing that they ignite the SRBs. But here's the other question I've got, Paul. At the end of the use of the external tank, I am guessing they don't drain the external tank all the way down to the bottom. If they did, your turbo pumps would be trying to pump a air bubble. I'm guessing they leave a couple of percent of hydrogen and or oxygen in that tank when they disconnect it. And the disconnect procedure has got to be very carefully timed, because a zillion gallons per second are pouring through the 17-inch diameter pipe when you're using the external tank. And at the instant you decide to... Let me drop.
Comment.
At the instant that you decide to disconnect the external tank, you have to instantaneously flip over from external supply of fuel to internal supply of fuel with no interruption, no change in pressures going into the turbo pumps, no bubbles being pumped. So in order to make sure at the end you're not pumping air, I am guessing they leave a couple of percent of fuel in the external tank. Answer that one, Paul, and then turn it over to John. To BS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was thinking about before. I was saying that you have to have valves on both sides to automatically shut down. You need the orbiter side to shut down, and then the panels close. And then when the external tank pulls away, that has to have some kind of valves to isolate that. Otherwise, it would be pouring out of the back of the external tank. Okay, you know. So, and that's right after MECO. They call it a main engine cutoff. So your solids bring up for almost 2 minutes. They separate from the orbiter. And then you're on the external tank. Once the external tank is gone, that's it. You don't have any more fuel for the main engines. And then you're coasting to orbit, and that's it. Now John had a question.
Hold on now, Paul. The main engines are still burning for some significant period of time after you've dumped the external tank. So you're flipping from external supply of fuel to internal supply of fuel with no interruption. After the external tank is dumped, those main engines are still burning for another minute or so. Over to you, Paul.
Now, they call that main engine cutoff, MECO. You don't have any... you don't have any more... You don't have your three engines still firing after the tank is gone, as far as I know, Dick. there wouldn't be any more fuel left. Those three engines never ever fire again once the tank is gone. You have other rockets all over the thing. You got your Ohm's rockets, your orbital maneuvering system of rockets, big two of them sticking out of the back. They fire multiple times to get you into a circularized orbit. That's probably what you're thinking about. And then eventually to deorbit. You'll use your Ohm's engine. Those, of course, have fuel on board. Back to you there.
Well, I can remember seeing lots of pictures where you're looking at the tail end of the space shuttle. You see the external tank fall away. You see the solid rocket boosters fall away. And you see the three engines still burning. And you might be right. When the external tank falls away, maybe the three main engines stop at that time. I thought they'd keep going for a little while longer. We're going to pass it over to John. I might get a chance to run over to my bookcase and pick up my Space Shuttle Operator's Handbook. I'm going to take a look at the timing diagram that's on the first few pages. KC2WGB, K2LAW. Go ahead, John.
I got the same book, but I don't have time to look. Very good. Go get it, Dick. Back to you, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, it's good Dick has that, because you may be able to buy that on the surplus market someday and you want to operate it. Paul, I was just thinking, maybe Dick can hear us. When they're scavenging the fuel, those huge pumps that they're pumping that liquid oxygen, liquid helium out, I know that the vent is not capable of supplying enough air to prevent vacuum. So maybe that's why they don't pump it down completely, because those tanks would collapse if they went into a vacuum situation. They're not built for that. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you're right. I know 10% is lost, so I can't imagine in the venting process, you know, everything getting vented at 10%. So, yeah, maybe they have, there's a lot of piping that goes from the shuttle down the service structure all the way to, you know, all the way to those big spherical tanks sitting there at Launch Complex 39A, 39B. They're going to be used again. They're going to be used for, at 39A, you're going to use the same spherical tanks for the, you know, the oxygen one anyway for the Falcon 9 Heavy. When that goes up next year, you'll see that. Back to you, John. I'll see if Dick's got an answer, if he's back.
Maybe he's looking in the Dewey Decimal Point thing that he has to locate the book. But he's probably back. Dick, over to you, sir.
Yeah, I didn't leave yet to go work yet. Paul was doing one of his normal presentations where I've got enough time to pick up my handy-talky to listen to what's going on while I walk around the house. I knew I wouldn't have enough time at this time, so I didn't go get the book yet. So I think you're saying there's a few percent of fuel is probably left in the external tank for a couple of reasons. One, to make sure the external tank stays inflated, because it's the pressure of the fuel that gives you inflation that gives it the mechanical stability. And second of all, you want to make sure your pumps do not pump any air. And I guess you're saying that the three main engines cease at the instant of time that the external tank is jettisoned. I guess all those pictures I've seen of the continuing of the burn of the three engines, I remember seeing that continuing of burn, and that may be after the SRBs are jettisoned, but the external tank is still there. And I guess by the time the external tank is empty, the craft is high enough up, you may not have a clear view from the ground anymore. So I may be remembering the wrong sequence when I remember the three engines continuing to burn after something was jettisoned. And maybe it was only the external SRBs. So I think you and I have concluded that most likely the fuel is in pure gaseous form when it enters the combustion chamber of the nozzle. And it's most likely been converted from the liquid form to the gaseous form as it goes through all those veins that are used around the perimeter of the nozzle of the jet engine, of the rocket engine. And that's where it absorbs the heat to make sure the rocket engine doesn't get melted. Let me drop the heat. And that heat is converting the fuel from liquid to the gaseous form. Now, one of the reports I read somewhere is that these Russian Model 180 engines that we used to buy, because of the recent change in our agreements with Russia, because of what they've done in the Balkans, I think we're no longer allowed to buy any more Russian rocket engines. What's going on with that situation, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, well, Boeing and Lockheed, it's called the United Launch Alliance. Right now they're still buying the Russian engines because they're not being, you know, it has to do with the Ukraine. Russia wants to get away from the Ukrainian engines as well. It's become a headache. The NK-33 engines, that was the main problem. They were the ones from the 1960s. And they were sitting on the shelf for decades. And Aerojet is the name of the company that bought them over. And essentially, they were the original rocket engines, and they, in turn, sold them and stole them onto the Antares rocket being built by Orbital. The Antares rocket was, you know, for a while sending up cargo to the International Space Station on the Cygnus rocket. Well, that was the rocket that failed 2 Octobers ago. That was the rocket engine that failed. They believe the turbos let loose. They're just not up to par. And they knew they had a problem because the previous May, before the explosion, they had one of these things in the test stand, and the same thing happened. Well, you'd think they would have stopped after that, but they didn't. And, you know, I would have called it and said, there's something wrong with these engines. But they went ahead and they installed each flight, they installed two of these MK-33s. Or after Aerojet got a hold of them and rebuilt them, they called the AJ-26s. And again, these are running on kerosene fuel and liquid oxygen. And the problem is now, the government said, let's do away with this. We don't want anything to do with it. Problem is, we also have other rockets, and they're called the 180s. And they're fine. They've been fine for forever. We've been using the Russian rockets, and they've been put on the Atlas V rocket. Two of them for every time they launch. At over a half a million pounds thrust at launch, so they're actually our heavy lift vehicle right now. So these rockets, we still have them. They're still going to be used. I don't know, there's been like 4 or 5 Atlas launches in the last 2 months, and everyone has these Russian rockets on it. It's not making the news, but no problem. They're actually very good rocket engines. But in the long run, even the United Launch Alliance is going to do away with these rockets that we want American made. And they signed a contract with Blue Origin. Blue Origin is making the BE-4s. And they're the ones I mentioned before that have liquid natural gas and liquid oxygen. And they will be replacing, you know, the Russian engines altogether, the good 180s, and they'll be putting them on the Atlas V rockets, as well as the new rocket that's being built by Blue Origin. So they'll be replaced. Problem is, Orbital, the same company that had the problem 2 Octobers ago that blew up, what do they do instead of waiting or, you know, doing something different? They're buying the, I think it's called the RS-191. Now, the 191s are coming out of Russia. Here's more engines coming from Russia. And they're not going to stop. I mean, they have long-term plans of eventually going with the same rockets that the Atlas is going to be using, being bought bought up from Blue Origin. But for the time being, they're going to be using these other Russian rockets called the 191s. So there's no end to it. Yeah, fine. They're going to get rid of it. They've gotten rid of the ones that caused the problems, the MK-33s, the ones from the 1960s. But now they have all these newer ones that they're still fooling around with. And you won't see all American rocket engines probably until 2020. You'll see all. Maybe a year before, you'll see all American rocket engines 5 years from now. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. I've got two versions of the Space Shuttle Operator's Manual. I call it handbook, but it's manual. It looks like you're right. The main engines burn up until 8 minutes. First of all, it's 2 minutes that you get out of the solid rocket boosters. But the main engines burn until 8 minutes and 38 seconds. That's when you get main engine cutoff, MECO. Three main engines shut down at 8 minutes and 38 seconds. 8 minutes and 54 seconds, almost 20 seconds later, the external tank separation takes place. And the orbital maneuvering system keeps burning up until beginning thrust up until 12 minutes and 24 seconds, but the three main engines cut off at 8 minutes and 34 seconds. You're right. So it looks like the main engines are only being fueled by the external tank. Your Ohm's engines then they'll bring you the rest of the, let's see now, from 8 to 12 is what, 4 more minutes. You burn the Ohm's engines in order to get into orbit. And they're always being fed by internal. That makes things, let me drop. That makes things a lot simpler. If you had to come up with the right kind of dynamics and timing of valves, so you switched over from external fuel tank fuel to internal fuel tank fuel without creating any pressure bump and bubbles and everything else, boy, that would be complicated. So it looks to me like the external tank is the only thing feeding fuel into your main three engines, and the internal fuel is feeding the Ohm's engines. Does that mean that did the Ohm's engines, I didn't check on that, did the Ohm's engines start later, or do you really have five liquid fuel engines running simultaneously there for a while? WS2N, K2LAW.
They would start later, and that would bring you more or less the rest of the way uphill, but now don't forget you're not circularized yet, so you got to wait until you're on the other side of the earth, and the Ohm's engines usually come on again for another 30 seconds or so, and circularize it. So, and it's a different kind of fuel than, you know, they're not running liquid hydrogen in the Ohm's engine. It's another different kind of fuel that they carry on board the orbiter. And those engines, of course, also deorbit them. You know, they'll face the shuttle the opposite direction, and the Ohm's engines, Ohm's engines will come on again and slow them down, and that's how they deorbit at the end of the mission. So a lot of things going on. And when you look at the bottom of the space shuttle, you'll see five cones sticking out. You see the three big main engines sticking out, and then at the top of the orbiter, on the port side and the starboard side, you see the other two cones sticking out, and they're your Ohm's engines, and they probably run maybe 10 or 12 feet into the back of the shuttle, the length of the shuttle, and they're tied into a couple of big tanks inside the back of the shuttle. Complicated machinery, no question about it. After that, they get to orbit, those big cargo doors got to open up, because inside the cargo doors, along the inside of the cargo doors are the radiators, and that's how they get rid of heat. And if that don't open up, the Ohm's engines will have to come on, and they'll deorbit. They cannot fly the orbiter with the closed doors. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Interesting, and I'm guessing that heat exchanger that's on the cargo bay doors that have to open, I'm guessing that the fluid in those might be ammonia. And I'm also guessing that the Ohm's engines do not ignite on the launch pad. The launch pad, you light your three main engines, and then 2.34 seconds later, after that swing back, you light the SRBs. So I guess it's only at the end of the MECO, main engine cutoff, that then you light the Ohm's engines after you've dumped the external tank. Then you do a short burn on those in order to get into orbit, and then 180 degrees later in the orbit, you do another burn of those to do a circularization of the orbit. So the Ohm's engines, it looks to me like they only come on at around the time that you dump the SRB, at the time that you dump the external tank. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yes, yeah, the tank has to be not only dumped but separated, and it usually winds up in the North Atlantic or the Indian Ocean, depending on the inclination that they shoot for, and that's the end of that tank. And I was going to mention something else. I'm more fascinated. I have not seen these things close up, but I'd love to see the bolts that hold this whole stack together. There's eight total of eight bolts. electrics that these exploding nuts, the actual nut part actually blows apart. I mean, you know, how reliable these explosive nuts have to be that they're going to blow off. Suppose they don't come off all the way. Suppose one don't go off. Here's these solid booster rockets igniting, and the whole thing's supposed to be taken off. And what would happen if one bolt didn't fire? That's what amazes me, that these exploding bolts, and they were all throughout the whole thing. I mean, they have, you know, they have them even with the solid booster, when it separates from the external tank. They have these exploding things going off. By the way, SpaceX has done away with that. They have, you know, on the, you know, they don't want anything to do with that. A lot of their separation stuff from second stage to first stage, you know, everything gets pushed apart. They've kind of done away with a lot of these explosive pyrotechnics. They have them, but they don't, you know, they cut back on that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I can see a couple of reasons for that. I very vaguely remember reading a couple of early reports of failure analysis where the pieces of shrapnel of the exploding bolt hit something and created some minor damage. On top of that, I am guessing that the ignition wire that fires the explosive bolts, I'll bet you there's two separate ignition wires there, Paul, so that if either one fails, the other can take over and you still explode the bolt. Because as you said, if those bolts that disconnect the external tank or the SRBs, if one of those bolts hangs up, and now you've got a SRB dangling, or you've got a external tank dangling, you're in a heap of trouble. You don't have an immediate failure because you're already above the atmosphere. But when you come back home, boy, is that going to give you grief. So I'll bet you those exploding bolts have a dual ignition system. And what is the latest spacecraft using instead of explosive bolts? Is there some kind of a solenoid that opens up a latch of some kind? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, they probably still have them for the takeoff, you know, holding down the Falcon 9. But, in other locations, the fairings that separate, they have all these spring type of mechanisms that push things apart. And the same thing with separation from first stage to second stage. And I read that SpaceX is trying to do away with any kind of exploding bolts. Well, you know, NASA has these things all over the place. And I'm fascinated by any of these systems. Suppose they fail. You know, there's so many different locations where they have them. I mean, even the unmanned craft that are going into, that go to Mars, you know, they have pyrotechnics all over the place. And they never seem to fail. It's amazing. And I'm running out of time. This is a space portion of the TechNet 174, just in case we run out of time here. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WS2N.
Yeah, we've used up our time. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1581 of the series that began 33 years and 1 month ago, roughly September 1982. A lot of water under the bridge since then. At that time, John was still crawling around the floor of his house in his diapers. I'm kidding. Bye-bye, you all. Enjoy. We'll be back next week and settle some more of these antenna questions, and let's see now, what else did we get into tonight besides antennas? Direction finding, a little bit of that, but I didn't forget what we discussed, but John's got a much better memory than me. KC2WGB, tie the ribbons on it, John. K2IW and TechNet. See you next week, if not the earlier.
KC2WGB, very good. Might not be long before I'm back in diapers, you know, it's about that time. Funny stuff. Yeah, I want to thank everybody for joining us and the questions, great questions, and, keep them coming, and we'll try to do it. Have fun and enjoy. That's what the hobby's about. Be kind. KC2WGB. We'll be clear. Good night, Dick. Good night, Paul. Everyone on the net.
QRW, WB2GXM.
It's a GXM. Go ahead. Start up with your name, sir.
Rich. Rick, quick question. I was looking for the URL of the coat hanger Yagi's. And last week I was looking for the recording, which of course didn't happen. Can you repeat that URL, please? Thank you.
Yeah, the coat hanger Yagi's are by my good buddy Kent Britton. Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. So you go to Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo.com. And you will see his printed circuit antenna company. And on the second or third page of his website, you'll see these cheap Yagis, I think they're called, or cheap antennas, cheap Yagis, something like that. And they come in various versions. All of them are indicated. And these are extremely forgiving designs. You don't have to make everything to the nearest thousandth of an inch. You get within an eighth of an inch of the dimensions, and you're home free on those coat hanger antennas. So I think you said your name was Rich, and tell me if you need a QSO or confirmation. W2, Golf X-ray Mike, K2LAW.
I'm all set, Rick. Thank you very much, and good night. WB2GXM clear.
Bye-bye, and good luck with those Yagis. Lots of people have built them, and nobody's complained that I know about.
N2XJN, KC2WGB. Nothing to hurt, KC2WGB clear.
Line experiments working.
Hey, Chuck. Welcome again. Pretty good. I'm noticing all different types of material that affect the line in some strange ways, similar to what you're having with that medicine bottle project you're experimenting with there. I've tried different plastics and cardboards, and so many of them can change the tuning of that line when I get it in a null position. Interesting stuff.
Well, I got a whole box of pill bottles, so I can certainly try and experiment and see if they heat up in the microwave, see if that's the direction that I need to know as far as the material, if it's causing me the problem or not. I'll find out very soon.
I've tried different pen bodies of pens that are different colors, and I think the pigmentation for the colors can affect it, because I noticed the ones that are like black or gray, they must have a lot of carbon in them, which is probably why they affect them more. But that'll be interesting when you find out exactly what's going on with that. And we had this discussion last year, I remember telling you about the little bottles that the nails come in, like in Home Depot. That's a different type of plastic. Maybe that would work out for you. But I can't wait till you put it in the microwave.
I think the pill bottles you're talking about are thinner in construction. I use a regular medicine pill bottle because they're fairly strong. You can put it in your pocket, lean against it, you're not going to break it or crack it very easily. But I think the other ones are a little less. Let me turn my other. I'm talking to the RLP, and I'm getting myself about a half a second delay in the audio coming out of me. I know, because I've got to turn the radio down a little bit, so it doesn't echo. I want to use something that's, you know, moderately strong, where if you lean against it, you're not going to crack the thing or crush the thing or do something crazy like that with it. That's why I chose that, and I've got plenty of them. But I didn't realize that the thing had an effect on art, at least. dB of loss that I can estimate so far by doing the measurements I've done with my test equipment, and that's moderate. Closer to the antenna, but I thought of trying to solve the resonance problem, making the circuit more resonant on frequency. It might help, with the sensitivity problem. But it's one problem after another. Can't put the thing together that way because the way I have it designed, the potentiometer for the intensity is actually mounted to the cap. So when I take the cap off, I can actually pull the wires, and this whole circuit board pulls out of the pill bottle. The circuit board cut to exactly fit in the length and width of the pill bottle. I shaved it down so it'd be a fairly tight fit. And I have a red cover that's glued into the end of the pill bottle and exactly aligns where the LED is. So when you put the thing in the bottle, you have a red cover over the LED so you can see it a little easier off the sides. That was the whole idea. I tried to make the whole thing simple, but it's not turning out that way.
Well, it's hard to say. I can tell you this, the experiments I've done so far, it takes almost 20 plus 20 dBm of signal applied to the end of the wire loop to actually get the bulb to light at some frequencies. At some frequencies it would light, some frequencies it would not light. But then again, you're coupling a 50 ohm output impedance of the output of this generator amplifier to a loop, you're sort of loading the loop down tremendously, so you're sort of changing one thing and it's not really doing what you like it to do. You have like too much coupling, I was trying to do this through air coupling. Now through air coupling, on some frequencies you're just using a UHF rubber antenna off the end of the generating amplifier, by holding it right against the loop itself, I can get the bulb to light, but that's like, direct, almost a direct connection. But that's only talking about plus 20 dBm, which is like a tenth of a watt. My HT will ignite the thing in the pill bottle at 4 watts, but I had difficulty lighting it at about a half watt or 10 dB, down in power change. Yes, I do. There's definitely a difference as you take out of the bottle. I can hold the HT a little further away and get it to light up a little brighter on low power level. Well, that's pretty easy to do. I can get, come back during the week and let you know about that. That's pretty easy to do that kind of test, but it's finding a bottle of the same durable type of construction that's made out of clear plastic or different plastic might be a challenge, because I went to 3 drugstores already. I showed them a bottle, like a sample, and they all said we use the same bottle, one after the other. So, buying it from another, buying like blanks, so to speak, from another drugstore wouldn't solve the problem. I guess they get it from the same vendor. Yeah, but these are just built, I say these things because I personally, I don't throw them out with my name on the label anyway. I take the label and destroy the labels, but I just, save the bottles. A lot of times I use a bottle simply when I'm taking something apart. It's a good way to put a little, screws. If I'm taking something apart, I'll take, put a little screws in the pill bottle, one, two of whatever variety of screws I have, different screws, just so I don't lose the stuff rolling around on the table, That's the main purpose why I keep them, because they're free. Well, some of the stuff I've taken apart is like, the Jap radio type of origin, either, commercially or whatever. And the last thing you want to do is lose the screws, because you'll never find the replacements. They're metric of some godly, ungodly size, whatever the hell they happen to be. You go crazy trying to find the exact size. So the last thing you want to do is lose them and have to order one screw from the company because you lost like a dope.
Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1984 with the release date of Friday, November 6, 2015, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. A new White House report urges better preparedness for geomagnetic storms. The radio amateur in upstate New York works QRP to activate a marshland. The Philippine Amateur Radio Association marks its 83rd year and in separate preparedness exercise.